Where is My Mind? Love that title. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on. You know, when I love the book. Let's start off with that. And I resonated with a lot of what you wrote about. And I remember, you know, reading, I thought back to the time when I started researching, you know, the non-physical realm and non-physical phenomena. And when I discovered the preponderance of evidence, which you chronicle very well in your book and produced by well-credentialed researchers, you know, like Dean Radin, and you see the odds against chance in some of the studies of a billion to one or a billion trillion to one. And I was bewildered. You know, I said, well, how could this not be known? I mean, how could this evidence be suppressed and not discussed? And I take it that troubles you as well, does it not?
It absolutely does. But when you're referencing the statistical results, those are sometimes difficult to wrap our heads around. It's kind of an abstract concept that's very scientific, and it's not something you can readily see. In right. many of these cases, what's happening is just beyond what chance would predict. So people aren't necessarily 100% correct when they're engaging in a psychic activity. They're just doing better than what chance would predict. And that's a subtlety that I think many people can get lost in.
Yeah, I mean, I was curious. I mean, you're obviously immersed in the technology world. You're in an industry that's based on logic and for the most part, material science. And contemplation of the nature of consciousness doesn't happen too often in the kind of work that you do. So was there a specific personal trigger that propelled you to embark on this kind of exploration?
Yes. I mean, the topic of consciousness was not something I was in undergrad or in my business career at all until the summer of 2016 when I was listening to podcasts, and I wasn't even seeking out podcasts on consciousness. I was listening to health and business podcasts, and on one of the shows, it's called Extreme Health Radio, they interviewed a psychic named Laura Powers who talked about her own psychic experiences, and she sounded pretty genuine. And I just remember being interested in what she was saying. It didn't change my life. And then she mentioned that she had her own podcast, which is called Healing Powers, where she interviews other people in the health and psychic space. So I ended up just turning that podcast on because I have a long drive from where I live in San Francisco down into Silicon Valley, and just was listening to some of the episodes and some of the conversations she was having. And over time, I heard enough people describing a picture of reality that was one that I was not familiar with, that was going against what I had been taught at Princeton and many other places and was not consistent with what many of the people around me were saying. So that was enough to spark my curiosity to start reading books and actually speaking with psychics and all that. And I got to a point where I realized that there was enough evidence I had been exposed to that I couldn't reconcile my old worldview. And that happened in the fall of 2016. And it was a very disorienting period for me because I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to think about life anymore. And I realized I had to basically restart the way I viewed reality.
And so you really, you know, you started all this in 2016, which is amazing because you've done a fantastic amount of research and you've interviewed, you know, many people. And I mean, you really delved into this with gusto. So, I mean, has it changed the way you live your life?
I would say dramatically. I was very much a materialist before getting into this research, and the term materialism in a scientific sense is the notion that everything in the universe can be reduced to matter, basically. So physical stuff, like I can touch my table here, and that's made of atoms of matter, and it's through the combination of matter in the universe that you end up with a biological being, like a human being or a dog or anything biological, and then from the being, like a human, a brain develops over time. And then consciousness, the thing that experiences that we all have right now, that consciousness emerges from the brain. It comes out of the chemical and electrical activity in the brain. At least that's what materialism would say. And that's what I thought science had proven already. I didn't even know there was a controversy. So if you buy into that idea of materialism, that the brain and more fundamentally that physical matter is what creates consciousness, then when the brain is not functional, when the body dies, in other words, then there can't be consciousness because the thing that produced the consciousness is turned off. And if you really dig into what that implies, one cannot find true meaning in life. One can try to rationalize meaning and make it up, but it implies that once you die, it's over, and whatever happens during your life is wiped out once you're dead. So I understood those implications and thought life was meaningless and actually struggled with that. It wasn't something I talked about all the time, but I just thought that's the way life was, and that was the situation we were in. So I wasn't fighting it. I just thought that life was inherently meaningless, and that's what science was teaching us. And then I was exposed to science, which challenged all of that. So I had to reconsider all of my assumptions.
And you're talking about, you made a great point in the book. I mean, you were talking about Einstein, who was a materialist. And Einstein said he couldn't prove that his conception was right, but he said that that was his religion. So as you point out, the foundation of modern science is a form of religion. That's kind of ironic, isn't it?
It is ironic. So if one looks at this belief of materialism, this gets into some of the philosophy, and I think Dr. Bernardo Kastrup has done a really good job of explaining this point, which is, that it requires a consciousness to experience anything. So if there's no consciousness, then we can't prove the existence of anything that exists, because in order to prove its existence, you have to actually experience it, if you actually want to prove it. So this notion that there was a material world first, like a big universe, and then consciousness came later, that cannot be verified, because that means there would have been no consciousness at the time to prove and verify that that universe existed, because there was no consciousness to experience it. Does that mean the universe didn't exist? It could have. It just means that we can't verify, it cannot be proven that the universe existed before consciousness. So that's the leap of faith that science takes, ironically, that science is based on this leap of faith. And that's what I was pointing out. And Einstein, I think, was humble to acknowledge that.
Yeah, and when we talk about the religion of science, or scientism, as you point out, it goes against the very principles of scientific research. I mean, scientists, refuse to test hypotheses and be open to new discoveries, which makes no sense at all.
It doesn't make sense to me. It's anti-scientific to throw out phenomena that someone just doesn't want to study. I think science should be about exploring things that don't make sense, exploring the anomalies, because we know that there's so many things in science we don't understand. For example, 96% of the universe, roughly, is considered to be made of dark matter and dark energy. In other words, there's the stuff out there that comprises most of the universe, and we don't know what it is. So we should expect that there would be scientific findings that would challenge whatever we believe right now to be true, because what we believe right now to be true is inherently incomplete.
I know we're coming up on a break, but would you mind taking a call from a listener before the break?
Sure.
Okay,
we have Sharon from Seattle, Washington. She's on line 3. Sharon, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Hi, Sharon. Did you have a question for Mark?
Hi. So I lost my 40-year-old son about a year ago, and I am trying to reconcile the fact that there's nothing there, or there is still a consciousness there. I mean, it's like I want it to be, but I don't know, and I'm so confused.
Well, thank you for calling in, Sharon, and I'm so sorry to hear about your son. One of the reasons I decided to write this book is to show the scientific evidence, which suggests that consciousness exists after the physical body dies. And I can understand the confusion you have, because we're dealing with a phenomenon that we can't see physically. I mean, in some cases, people can see apparitions, but in most cases, we're dealing with something that's beyond our ordinary senses. And the way that I frame reality in this book is based off of what Bernardo Kastrup, a philosopher, says about consciousness, which is that all of reality is like a stream of water, or water's like consciousness, and each of us is a whirlpool within that stream. So we have an individual identity, but we're fundamentally connected within the stream. And if you imagine that a whirlpool dissolves into the broader stream, that's sort of like analogously when the physical body dies, the consciousness continues just in a different form. And there are a number of experiments that suggest that this might be true. And we can get into this after the break, I'm sure. But the near-death experience is one case where a person has a brain that is not functional, and yet the person comes back to life and reports memories accurately that happened during the time that their brain was off. So these are the pieces of evidence which suggest that a consciousness can exist even when the physical body is not functional. And beyond that, there are studies on mediumship where certain individuals have an ability to communicate with the consciousness of a person who is no longer in a physical body.
Okay. But with this mediumship, I mean, how do you find a person who is really reliable?
That's a great question.
If I could just interject, I mean, there are a lot of resources. I mean, Forever Family Foundation has been conducting a certification program since 2005, you know, under controlled conditions. There are some other organizations like Winbridge and some others that they're not testing mediums, you know, now, but they did in the past. And there are several university studies and then, you know, word of mouth and so forth. But and it's helpful, as Mark points out in his book, as he mentioned, not only mediumship studies, but going to read about, you know, other phenomenon like deathbed visions and end of life experiences and reincarnation and the things, and a lot of psi phenomena like telepathy and so forth. So the stuff is real, and we encourage you to read up on it. And thanks for calling. And we're going to go to a break now. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Stay with us.
The Camlack Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the Camlack Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlack.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
Imagine seeing spirits are spontaneously speaking indigenous Brazilian rainforest languages. Janet Mayer, a psychic medium, does just that. In her new book, Spirits, They Are Present, she opens the door to her private life in order to share her compelling, fearful, and at times humorous journey, providing evidence that when we die, we simply make a transition to another life. Spirits, They Are Present, available now at www.janetmayer.net, Amazon, and other online booksellers. Order your copy today.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
We all grieve in different ways, and let's face it, grief hurts. Losing a loved one is usually the hardest event we will ever face. We can throw our hands up and become hardened by our grief, or we can take positive steps to transform it. Love Knows No Death, a groundbreaking and powerful grief transformation method, can be what you've been looking for to provide some peace and understanding. It was created and written by medical doctor and professor Dr. Piero Calvi Perazzetti, and it's a combination of a self-help workbook and video course. The workbook has the power to lessen grief and foster significant healing, and has already helped countless people to not only lead productive lives, but to do so with the knowledge that they will indeed see their loved ones again. The workbook can be purchased for $19.95 on Amazon or on the ForeverFamilyFoundation.org Grief and Loss page, where a digital version is also available for $9.95. Love Knows No Death. Truer words have never been spoken.
So Starseed Gems Studios in Cocoa, Florida fuses cremation ashes within art glass, making beautiful stones. The ashes are visible in the darkness and resemble a beautiful night sky. Starseed Gems, developed by the parents of a young man who passed away, are set in hand-sculpted silver and gold settings. Prices start at $150. Visit www.starseedgems.com or call 321-632-7770. That's www.starseedgems.com or 321-632-7770.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation.
If you are just tuning in, our guest tonight is Mark Gober. If you have a question or comment for our guest, the number here is 888-627-6008. This show is sponsored by the Comlock Center, and they can be found on the web at comlock.com. Bob?
And I want to remind everybody that Mark Gober's book is An End to Upside Down Thinking, and he has a very informative podcast, Where Is My Mind? And you can go on any of the major pod, Apple and Spotify and so forth. And
just Google it.
Yeah, and find it. Mark, what do you think? Should we stop using the term paranormal when discussing things that don't fit into mainstream thinking? Do you think it's become like a negative term?
Well, the term itself has a connotation, paranormal. It means it's outside of the normal, which assumes that we know what normal is. And I think that's where we've gone wrong. Is how do we know what's normal? I mean, to someone 500 years ago, cell phone communication would be paranormal. I mean, how could it be possible that two people across the world could communicate wirelessly? That would make sense, because at the time, that wasn't normal. So, I agree with you. I think it would probably be proper to use a different term, just because the term paranormal is so charged with, I think, a lot of baggage, and there's mixed connotations with it. I think we should be using more precise terminology.
Yeah. Another thing, I remember reading, I think you mentioned this in the book and into Upside Down Thinking, but I remember after reading about William James and F.W. Myers and, you know, the theory that the brain acts as a filter of consciousness as opposed to a generator of consciousness. And that resonated with me. What are your thoughts about that concept, that our brains act as filters?
I think it's a really good analogy. It's the one that I use most often when I think about what the brain's role is. So earlier I talked about the idea that the brain isn't producing consciousness like most scientists say it does, but we know that the brain has a relationship with consciousness because, let's say someone gets in a car accident and has brain damage, let's say in the part of the brain responsible for vision, then we might see a corresponding change in that person's ability to see. So we see a change in the brain and a change in consciousness. This happens all the time, like with prescription drugs, vitamins, injuries. We know there's a tight correlation between what happens in the brain and what happens to our consciousness. So the question is, what's the link there? Why is there a correlation? And some people would say, well, because the two are related, it must mean that the brain's causing consciousness. And there's an error there, potential error. And in statistics, people say correlation does not imply causation. And I'll give an analogy again from Dr. Bernardo Kastrup. He says, imagine if you have a large fire, lots of firefighters show up. You have a larger fire, more firefighters show up. So there's a strong correlation between the size of the fire and the number of firefighters that appear at the scene. But if you ask someone, are the firefighters causing the fire? No, they're related to it, but they're not the cause. So now back to your question, what is the relationship between the brain and consciousness, if there is this relationship? And what we actually find in a number of independent areas is that when the brain has a reduction in functioning, there is a heightened or enriched consciousness, which supports the idea that the brain is acting in a filtering capacity, meaning the brain is actually getting in the way of a much broader type of experience that if we got the brain out of the way, we would experience. So there are a number of examples of that. One is recent studies on psychedelics, where people have an enriched reality, and yet there's a reduction in brain functioning. But I think the most extreme examples are in near-death experiences, which I mentioned before, where a person has minimal or no brain functioning at all, and yet their consciousness feels realer than normal. They talk about thinking that is clearer than usual and more logical than usual with a brain that is either barely functioning or completely off. So when you put pieces of evidence together like that, another one is terminal lucidity. These are cases where a person is near death and has had a long-term illness. So, for example, Alzheimer's. So a person might have had Alzheimer's for many years, hasn't been very lucid, and then within a few days before the person dies, they become completely normal. So we know their brain has been damaged for a long time, and yet they have a normal and lucid consciousness. And it's these types of anomalies which suggest that the brain is, in fact, filtering a much broader reality. It's the lens through which we experience the world, but it's actually getting in the way of something much bigger and broader.
Yeah, and when you talk about terminal lucidity, I mean, I know it's amazing to me personally because I've experienced that, you know, with loved ones. And what's fascinating is that if there's no apparent medical explanation and yet it happens, so that logically I would think that there has to be a spiritual explanation as opposed to a medical explanation. I mean, why would somebody whose brain is compromised and they're physically or mentally incapacitated be able to speak in a clear and lucid fashion? Makes no sense from a medical perspective. But that's an interesting topic. Are these things spiritual phenomena? I mean, do you look at them in a spiritual sense?
Well, I think it's first important to define the term spiritual, and it's one that I purposely left out of the book because I know how I would have reacted to that term before I started this research. I had a really negative reaction to the term spiritual because I thought it had this implication of like wishful thinking that, yeah, it would be really nice if there were life after death and if there were these other dimensions of reality where life existed and consciousness existed, but that's wishful thinking because it's our human nature to try to comfort ourselves. That's how I would have thought about the term. But if we think about spiritual, if we define that term as a realm of reality beyond what our physical senses can perceive, I would say absolutely that's what I'm pointing towards, and I think that's what is the nature of reality.
Yeah, I mean, I have this debate all the time with a lot of mediums when we talk about whether the work that they do is spiritual in nature. And you're right, it depends on how you define spirituality. But there are people that we've come across over the years that they believe that everything comes from a higher source, that telepathy is a spiritual endeavor. And that's where I don't agree. I mean, I think it's just simply part of who we are. We're just using senses that are not the known senses, that they fall into a different category. So, I mean, I think it's a mistake when we attribute everything to being spiritual in nature. I don't know if you agree with that.
It really is a question of definition.
Yeah.
The way I look at reality is that everything is consciousness. Everything is a modulation of consciousness, even the physical realm. So if one wanted to, one could say that everything in the physical realm is actually spiritual. So it's right. Like, where do you draw the line? And I think we have cultural definitions. But I would say generally, if someone were to ask me, Mark, now do you think there is a spiritual reality in the conventional sense of the word? I would say absolutely.
Yeah. When people, you know, we were talking before about consciousness and people that have their brain incapacitated to varying degrees and yet have these different experiences. So altered states seems to be a catalyst for receiving this so-called non-local information, because it's sort of when the brain steps out of the way, that might be an explanation why people have these dream visitations at night, or as you mentioned, you know, the people whose brain stem is gone and yet they have these near-death experiences, queer and lucid things. So do you think that the brain has anything to do with receptive of non-local information? I mean, it could just as well be another organ in our body. I mean, people talk about the heart playing a role in a telepathic process as well. So maybe we're looking in the wrong place.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think we know enough about all this. I think it's possible that the brain is involved and that there might be other parts of the body that are involved as well. I mean, you mentioned the heart. There's a book that I reference in my book called The Heart's Code by Dr. Paul Pearsall, where he looks at cases of organ transplant donors and the person who receives the organ, sometimes it's a heart and sometimes it's not a heart, the receiver, the person who now has the organ, takes on personality traits and memories of the person who originally had the organ. And one of the most striking cases that he references is of a young girl who received a heart through a heart transplant, and she started to have crazy nightmares where she was being murdered. And it got so bad that her mother took her to a therapist, and the therapist said, we need to explore this. So they ended up looking back into who donated the heart, and the heart was given from a girl who had been murdered. So allegedly, according to the story, the therapist was able to take details down from the little girl's dreams, and they were able to track down the person who murdered the girl.
Pretty cool.
Which is remarkable. But it raises the question, though. I mean, that seems like the consciousness of the person who originally had the heart, that little girl, some of that consciousness or memory or something was transferred into another body, and that was not the brain. So, I mean, it goes back to your question about what's the brain's role and are there other organs involved?
Yeah. What do you think is going on with savants, you know, who exhibit these just extraordinary abilities? I mean, do you think that they're able to access information fields that most of us can't?
I think that's a good way to think about it. If we view the brain as this filtering mechanism, some might call it a receiver. I think filter is maybe a more precise term. If we adjust the way the brain functions, we might adjust what it is filtering or what the brain is able to tune into. So we see sometimes people that are savants from birth where they actually have deficiencies in their social abilities or other abilities, and yet they're incredible at math or they're incredible at music. But other times people become savants spontaneously through a brain injury, for example. And even the savants that are born with deficiencies in certain areas, when their brains are scanned, the scientists find deficiencies in their brain relative to what we call a normal brain. So there's this pattern of having a brain that's a little bit different and then an ability to tap into consciousness in a different way. And that's what seems to be the case to me, that the savant is tapping into a part of consciousness that the quote-unquote normal brain isn't because of the way that other brain is configured.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of like people that have enhanced physical senses. For instance, if they're not sighted, if they're blind, you know, their sense of hearing becomes more intense. You know, and so maybe it's just it's similar to that we're all able to gain access to this information, but over the years it's become we've suffered from atrophy and it's just been weaned out of us. You know, maybe it's something that the ancients were able to do at one time. We have to rediscover that.
I think that's very likely. It's something that we're not taught in school. We're not taught to cultivate this ability that seems to be innate, even if it's subtle in some cases. And maybe in the case of savants and other people that have brains that are configured in a certain way or maybe other organs, they're just able to tap in differently. And there's like a spectrum of abilities. In the same way that in basketball, you have someone like LeBron James or Michael Jordan, and they're at the far end of the spectrum. They're the best of the best, but an everyday person can dribble a basketball. And maybe that's what these abilities are like, is that some people are naturally more gifted than others, but with practice, one can improve one's abilities.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and we see them that in the mediumship world. You know, there's a misconception that people have that every medium is the same, you know, just by the very fact that they're a medium, you know, but there are a tremendous variation in the evidence that they can provide. But there's also, as you mentioned, there's evidence that somebody with, you know, intuitive ability can be trained to enhance it. So it's I don't know where the starting point is. I don't know if everybody is born with intuitive ability. It seems to me that it's likely that some have it where it's you can't even recognize it, but I don't know whether they could be trained to be a medium. But there are, if you come from a certain starting point, I think it's true that our abilities, there are exercises to go through and meditations and certain trainings that can really enhance it. And, you know, I mean, do you think that We all can become Michael Jordans? No, I don't think so, right?
Maybe not Michael Jordans. I think maybe each of us has a max that we can achieve. But I think all of us probably have the capacity to improve. And when I talk to people that study this, like I interviewed Russell Targ, who ran the U.S. government psychic spying program in the 1970s and 80s and worked with the CIA and has seen this stuff and worked with some of the Michael Jordans of psychic abilities. He says that you can train anyone to do this, and he's done that, where you can teach people meditative techniques to quiet their mind, basically to allow the filter of the brain to quiet down. An analogy I like to use is, if consciousness is the sun, our brain and our emotions and thoughts, those are like clouds that block the rays of the sun. And there are things we can do to allow those rays of the sun to shine through and to remove the clouds. And that's sort of the enhancement of psychic abilities that certain people can teach.
Mm. What about the role that emotions play? I mean, there's some evidence that emotions have an effect on telepathic communication. Some of the research, shows that. And it certainly seems that it plays a role in mediumistic communication, where there's a bond, an emotional bond, between the sitter and the discarnate. So do you think that having... loving somebody or having some strong emotional connection increases the receptiveness of such information?
I talk about telepathy in Chapter 5 in my book, and there is some evidence which suggests that the telepathic effect, which happens in people that are not emotionally close, is heightened when the two people are closer emotionally. So it could be a mother and a child. It could be two people that are in an intimate relationship. There seems to be a tighter connection in those cases, which it kind of makes sense. If you're on the similar frequency, maybe you're tapping into something similar. And we also see this with identical twins, to the extent that it's not just mental activity that they're able to transmit to each other. Sometimes there's a physical manifestation, which is pretty crazy to think about. And what I mean by that is, if one of the twins is injured, the other twin who's far away and doesn't even see the injury feels the injury in the same spot.
Yeah, it's uncanny, but yet it happens time after time. And the emotional bond between, like a mother and a child, where one just instinctively knows that something's up, so it can't be explained by materialist thinking, that's for sure.
Yep.
We are talking with Mark Gober. The book is An End to Upside Down Thinking. The website is markgober.com, and the podcast is Where Is My Mind? We're going to take a quick break. Lots more to talk about with Mark, so stay with us.
The CAMLAC Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the CAMLAC Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlac.com, that's KAMLAK.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
Am I Psychic is a mobile app designed using statistics, science, and parapsychological protocols to test psychic ability using fun games. Each game has two unique modes. In psychokinesis mode, influence the game using mind over matter ability. In extrasensory perception mode, guess which random option will be chosen. Am I Psychic can store your results in an anonymous database used to eventually publish in academic journals. Available on the App Store and Google Play. Go to ampsychicapp.com and be a part of proving psychic phenomena to the world. Some profits will be donated to the Rhine Research Center.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
We all grieve in different ways, and let's face it, grief hurts. Losing a loved one is usually the hardest event we will ever face. We can throw our hands up and become hardened by our grief, or we can take positive steps to transform it. Love knows no death. A groundbreaking and powerful grief transformation method can be what you've been looking for to provide some peace and understanding. It was created and written by medical doctor and professor Dr. Piero Calvi Perazzetti, and it's a combination of a self-help workbook and video course. The workbook has the power to lessen grief and foster significant healing, and has already helped countless people to not only lead productive lives, but to do so with the knowledge that they will indeed see their loved ones again. The workbook can be purchased for $19.95 on Amazon or on the foreverfamilyfoundation.org grief and loss page, where a digital version is also available for $9.95. Love knows no death. Truer words have never been spoken.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation.
For those who are just tuning in, our guest tonight is Mark Gober. This show is sponsored by the Comlock Center, and they can be found on the web at comlock.com. As always, we want to remind our listeners to check the events page on our website, foreverfamilyfoundation.org, for all the latest events and happenings. Coming up free this coming February, we have on February 2nd at 1 p.m. Central Time, our Afterlife Discussion Group in La Porte, Texas. On February 8th, from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern and 11 to noon Pacific and everything in between and on the sides, our Visionary Explorers Group meets online. And on February 11th at 6:45 p.m., our Cold Spring Harbor, New York Afterlife Discussion Group meets at 6:45 p.m. Our annual winter grief retreat, Love Knows No Death, was another fabulous and healing weekend, and we offer the deepest thanks to Forever Family Foundation certified mediums Angelina Diana, Doreen Malloy, and Renata Santarelli, along with Dr. Piero Calvi Parasetti, who traveled all the way from Scotland as our special guest facilitators. Attendees can visit the website for their private page with all the links and information from the website. And we want to remind our listeners to save July 10th through 12th this summer for the Summer Grief Retreat in Chester, Connecticut. Our Holiday of the Earth Raffle 2020 is up and running on our website. One chance is only $5, and you could be one of five winners of medium readings with Forever Family Foundation certified mediums Tracy Lee Nash, Neil Zapowski, Renee Buck, Catherine Nadal, and Eliza Ray. Our 2020 webinar schedule begins on Sunday, February 23rd, with Dr. Stafford Betty presenting When Did You Ever Become Less by Dying? Several of our webinars this year will be at various times and on alternate days of the week to accommodate other time zones. So check the website for registration information, and please pay attention to the dates and times. And please help us keep all of our programs going by visiting our website and clicking on the donation button. It's on every single page. Because of the work we do not receive the grants and funding that all other traditional not-for-profits enjoy. You can also help us pay our bills by participating in iGive.com Amazon.com, Amazon Smile, and great nonprofits. And follow us on our YouTube channel for great stories and videos at youtube.com/afterlifeeducation. Back to you, Bob.
And we're back with Mark Gober, G-O-B-E-R. He has a wonderful book, which we recommend, An End to Upside Down Thinking. And you can learn more on Mark's website, which is his name, markgober.com. Before we get back with Mark, let's go to a caller.
We have Melissa from Michigan, if she's still on the line. Melissa, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Right. Did you have a question for Mark?
Actually, I did have a question, but at this point, if you don't mind, I would love to share a couple of comments based on everything that Mark was talking about, which I really want to thank you for having him and thank him, because this has stimulated so much. It's kind of like memories of truth coming back to me that are very healing. So that's where I'd like to start. I want to share a couple of things. I guess I was thinking I'll go from here backwards, but I guess I'm going to start kind of back where you were. And I did want to say that you have helped me so much by the one statement that it takes consciousness to experience, because the one thing, when my father had had a stroke, my son and I would just, I mean, we would look at each other, because there were, he would have times where all of a sudden, it's like he never had a stroke. He could walk fine, and he talked coherently. It was like his consciousness was back fully, and we would think, oh, my gosh, he's healed. And then, you know, after a while, he'd be back as he was. He couldn't, you know, he couldn't function, and he couldn't, and he was, you know, his memory, he could just repeat the same thing over and over, but he would have these moments, and it was quite phenomenal. I mean, and this talk tonight has just helped me, you know, validate that. And also the other thing is, like, I was with him when he, you know, crossed over, and it was the most interesting phenomena, because he was completely paralyzed, and he had been without, he couldn't move, he had no facial movement, and right before he died, he took this big breath, and he had the biggest smile on his face. I mean, he was able to pull up all of the muscles. He had this big, beautiful smile, and he let out that breath, and that was it. It was just, I mean, I don't know. To me, that was just really phenomenal. That I just kind of want to, you know, tell you just briefly a couple of things. And I really tuned in to the consciousness of the heart. I had heard that story before, but I was also thinking of heart math. But when you told that story, it just, I got so much truth about consciousness lying within the heart that really resonated. I think that that would be a great thing for us to all, you know, or the people that do it, to study that. And
yeah, we really appreciate your comments. I'm sure Mark thanks you for that. I mean, unfortunately, we have to move on with Mark, but and I thank you, you know, on behalf of our show and Mark, because your comments are well taken.
Thank you, Mark.
All right. I wish I had gotten to my son first. That was the most phenomenal thing. He crossed over a few months ago, and I was going to share something, but I understand you're busy, and I'll try and get on another time. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm so sorry about your loss. Mark, what I really wanted to ask you is, you chronicle very well about all the research and the side data, and there's a school of thought that we're not getting anywhere by coming up with more and more side data. You know, if the mainstream hasn't taken notice by now, you know, they never will. So what do you think? I mean, what needs to be done to spread awareness?
I really think it comes down to publicity and awareness of the extent of the research that's been done and the types of people that are conducting the research. I don't think it's well known in the mainstream. So I don't think it's necessarily that we need more results, which, I mean, it doesn't hurt, but we already have so many. It's a matter of getting it to the mainstream somehow. And that's one of the reasons I decided to write the book. And I was hoping that coming from my background, I would be able to reach new audiences with information that some people have known about for a long time. But many of my peers, I mean, most of what's written in my book, they've never heard of, and they're well-educated people. So I think it's a matter of, it's like a PR game, public relations game, where the more skeptical side has been prevailing in being able to, I don't know, downplay some of the findings. I haven't seen the progression as much because I'm newer to this field. But I recently joined the board of directors at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, where a lot of this research is being conducted. And I think the emergence of places like that, that are continuing to get their research out, and it's starting to be recognized by the American Psychologist Journal, which is the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Psychological Association, in 2018 published a meta-analysis of many of the studies that have been done at these institutes, and they show statistical results. So for a mainstream journal to publish results like that, I think it's going to be those kinds of findings that help to move the needle.
I think so, and equally important are the anecdotal accounts, aside, you know, from the formal research, because I think that's probably the best way we'll be able to change worldview about these things. You know, if people would only openly discuss personal experiences that they had, you know, many of the experiences that you write about in the book, that will go a long way into changing mainstream thinking. You agree?
I completely agree. I think personal experiences are the most powerful way for people to transform. And I think my journey in some ways has been rare because I was so immersed in the data. But even in my journey, I had personal experiences, whether it was synchronicity, where things happened that I just, using my logical mind, I couldn't reason that those things happened by chance, if I looked at, you know, how improbable they were. And also working with psychics and mediums and just seeing that they were able to know things sometimes that I couldn't explain. It was those personal anecdotes combined with the data that really did it for me. So I think getting people to somehow experience it is a key part of this. And what I'm hoping with my book and podcast and everything I'm doing and even these conversations is to be another voice to open the door for people. Because I think once the door is open, it allows for some of this to enter people's lives in subtle or not so subtle ways.
I think you're absolutely right. And one of the values to your book and such work is that when people become aware of the science, even if they were a left-brain thinker, that in some ways opens them up to recognizing personal experiences that they just never realized they were having or just dismissed. So there's a value to learning about these things, you know, depending on your mindset. I mean, some people consider themselves to be very spiritual and they don't need, you know, but for other people, you're certainly one, you know, I was one. My pathway had to be through the science. That's the only way to make an impact. And I see that you're the same way. I mean, you end the book with an important question about the implications of all of this evidence. What are the implications for world peace? Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, this is ultimately why I'm doing the work I'm doing. The science is important, but it's what the science leads to that I'm actually most interested in. And I actually had to chronicle the science to prove it to myself almost. And I wanted to share that with others. But the implications, how does it impact our everyday living? That's where I think this is really critical. The way we view reality ultimately shifts all of our priorities and the things that we do and the way we act in life. So when I'm asked about this, your question about implications, the first thing I'd like to point to is it's known as the life review in the near-death experience, which is often reported. So when a person has a near-death experience, this means their body is typically in some kind of major trauma. It could be cardiac arrest where the heart stops. It could be general anesthesia where the brain shouldn't be functional, capable of producing lucid experiences. So in these near-death experiences, people often report a life review where they relive their whole lives in a flash. So something happens where time is warped because it's a short amount of time, and yet they relive their whole lives. But what's the kicker here is that when they have the life review, they often relive events through the eyes of the people that they impacted, and they feel the effects of the loving or non-loving actions on that person as if they were that person. So in my podcast, I interviewed Danion Brinkley, who's had four near-death experiences, and each time he reported a life review. In his case, it was particularly extreme because he fought in Vietnam, and he told me that he was vicious in combat. So during his life reviews, he actually relived the deaths of the people that he killed in combat through their eyes. And not only that, he experienced the pain of the child who would no longer have a father, as if he were the child. So there's an interconnectivity that is suggested by all of the things that we're talking about. But the life review is, I think, the clearest example of what one might call the one mind, as Erwin Schrödinger, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, called it. This one stream of consciousness of which we are individual whirlpools. We're individuations of this unified, interconnected stream. And somehow in this other dimension of reality in the near-death experience, people experience the reality through multiple lenses. So if we take the implications of that, I mean, how might we live every day if we thought a life review was even possible, that we might relive how we, you know, acted towards people? And what people say from the life review, like Danion Brinkley, who became a hospice volunteer after he had his near-death experiences, people say, look, the material world, that the material achievements are not what you care about in the life review. What you care about is how you treated people, and it's the small things. It's sometimes how you treated the cashier, because you might feel the pain if you were not nice to someone. So imagine if people had a priority shift based on this view of reality, not just as a belief, but as where the evidence scientifically is pointing us. I think that could shift behavior on a global scale.
I couldn't agree more, and I think you hit it right on the head. I mean, the woes of society today are usually connected to the feeling that we're operating solo. We're separate entities. Life is random. There's no meaning or purpose. And if we get to feel that everything is connected and all of our actions have repercussions, as you point out in the life review, how quickly would wars end if the people that are shooting the guns felt the bullets go through them? You know, so it makes perfect sense, and well said, Mike. We couldn't agree more. I want to tell everybody that we have been talking with Mark Gober. It's MarkGober. The website is markgober.com. The book is called An End to Upside Down Thinking, Dispelling the Myth that the Brain Produces Consciousness and the Implications for Everyday Life. Mark's podcast is Where Is My Mind? And you could just look that up, and amazing guests that he has constantly, and he asks some probing questions. So, Mark, thanks so much for being with us. Really appreciate it. Hope you'll join us again.
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for the work that you're doing in the world.
Thanks, Mark.
It's wonderful.
Have a good evening.
We now ask our listeners to please join us on our global peace prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind. Now let us as one consciousness give our energy of loving thought by praying like this. To love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And now it's time to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.